The next case is 08-1265, Siskins and Associates, Inc. versus the Committee to Elect Timothy Grindell. Mr. Slater.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices. My name is John Slater. I serve as counsel for Senator Tim Grindell and the Committee to Elect Senator Tim Grindell. I'm here with Attorney Vacanti, also of my office. I'm with Buckingham, Doolittle, and Burroughs. This case centers around the issue of responsibility. And by the way, I'd like to retain 3 minutes for my rebuttal.
Your time there on the clock.
Thank you. But the issue, the civil rules focus on responsibility of the litigants to a lawsuit, and also focus on a responsibility of the trial judge, court of appeals, or otherwise. In this specific case, the focus is what is ultimately meant and what is the purpose behind Rule 3A of the civil rules, which specifically require two items for the commencement of a lawsuit. One is the filing of a lawsuit, and two is the service of that lawsuit upon the defendants within 1 year. That is the obligation that a plaintiff has when a plaintiff files a lawsuit to file that, to obtain service within 1 year. It's clear under the civil rules. And therefore, the focus for today in Civil Rule 3A really focuses on the responsibility of a plaintiff to diligently pursue their lawsuit in light of Rule 3A. And this court has recognized that 3A has several purposes, but specifically in the Saunders case, this court recognized that among other things, the purpose of Civil Rule 3A is designed to promote the prompt and orderly resolution of litigation, as well as eliminating the unnecessary clogging of court dockets caused by undue delay. The rule puts litigants on notice that a reasonable time will be afforded in order to obtain service of process over defendants. Such a rule goes to the essence of the civil procedure and is not, in our view, a mere technicality designed to delay parties their day in court. The court goes on in Saunders and indicates that a plaintiff is the master of his or her own case. The failure of a plaintiff to comply with the rules promulgated under a uniform modes of procedure should not compel the court to carve out a limited exception in order to grant such a litigant another opportunity to do that which they failed to do in the first place.
What do you find to be the distinction between the fact patterns in this case and that in Goolsbee?
In Goolsbee, the focus of the case was, one, on whether the instruction to a clerk to serve a complaint or an amended complaint was indeed a commencement of the action or a filing of the action. But then, factually, it changed because the statute of limitations period was about to run, and the focus of the court was primarily on the savings statute. However, this court, I believe, and it's our position that the Supreme Court's decision in Goolsbee is in line with a proper interpretation of 3A, that is a responsibility of the plaintiff to obtain service. In fact, in Goolsbee, Justice Moyer, in writing the opinion, focused on the fact that the trial court actually had a responsibility after 6 months to look at this case, and the clerk should have, in Goolsbee, to determine whether it should have been dismissed or not, and whether there was good cause for the failure to obtain service. In this case, we have a plaintiff who files an action to obtain service by certified mail, which is the proper way they can do it under the rules. And from that point, for more than a year, they did nothing. Service wasn't obtained. The record clearly shows service wasn't obtained, and nothing happened. They then, on their own, dismissed the case without prejudice, a notice dismissal. One point of clarification, the record in the Court of Appeals decision and the trial court decision talk about the original filing of this complaint was on October 23, 2004, when in fact it was on September 23, 2004. That was a mistake in the opinion, but clearly the record indicates, and if you review the docket, it indicates that in September of 2004, this lawsuit was filed. It was the clerk of courts issued a certificate of service to obtain service. It failed, and plaintiff and their counsel did nothing. For more than a year, under 3A, the action was not commenced. They decided to do a 41A1A dismissal, which they have the right to do. They are the master of their own destiny. They have the right to do it. But under Civil Rule 41A1A, they have the right to do it one time. Then what they did is they refiled the complaint approximately a week later against Senator Grundell and the committee. They then file an amended complaint within about 3 or 4 months in February, and they do not try service until more than a year later, in fact, 16 months later. And then at that point, they try service by ordinary mail. And guess what? They actually got service. But their attempts earlier completely failed. The problem with their attempt in 16 months after their filing of the second complaint is, again, 3A requires for an action to be commenced, you've got to obtain service within 1 year. The reason why this is a critical issue for the court and of statewide concern is that when you look at a plaintiff's responsibility in pursuing an action, they again can control their own destiny. They controlled their destiny in this case. They filed their lawsuit, they did nothing, dismissed it on their own. They have the right under the 41A1A to do so. Secondly, they took action by again filing a complaint. Possibly under Goolsbee, they could have instructed the court for service. That would have been akin to a refiling. And in the Schaefer case, as the trial court recognized, once you do a refiling, something has to happen with that original complaint. And if the plaintiff is the one taking the action, the only thing that could occur is a notice dismissal.
Counsel, and that's really the crux here, is the double dismissal rule. Everything
clearly
you've
is.
Talked up to this point, I'm glad we got to the 41A issue here.
Yes.
You're asking us to say without any equivocation, or you're saying without any equivocation, I guess it would be better, is that because they filed an amended, refiled complaint, that eradicated their second filing, which acts as a dismissal, a double dismissal, a voluntary dismissal.
That is correct, except the only nuance to it is when they filed that amended complaint, they didn't take action to serve it until 16 months later. It was the action of instructing service, just as this court found in Goolsbee. Action of instructing service after the time, 1 year time period of service had run, triggers a refiling, but then also it would have to cause something to occur with that pre-existing complaint.
You'd have no problem if they had obtained service on that second complaint within 12 months of its filing.
That's correct.
And it's because it went beyond the 12 months, the 12-month prohibition in obtaining service.
Correct.
That it is a dismissal. The problem that you confront, of course, is that the rule says a dismissal is for failure to perfect service is other than on the merits. And so maybe what you're asking for is an amendment to that rule that says unless if it's a second filing, it is with prejudice. You're really concerned about whether it's without prejudice or with prejudice, aren't you?
That is correct, Your Honor. And the reason why, first of all, for the civil rules to be read together and to really work together, you need to take a look at multiple areas. And one of them definitely is the 41B of the revised code, which deals right. with the issue of when you have a dismissal for failure to obtain personal service. And really the nuance in this case is, even though it was asserted, and if you read some of the text on ultimately, how do you deal with this issue? There is some confusion on the appropriate method. Is it a motion to dismiss under 12B? Is it, you know, some other motions or a motion to strike? But ultimately, what you find that if you look at Goolsbee and you look at 3A, once you've gone beyond the year and you haven't obtained service, the court doesn't have jurisdiction to extend, for example, that time, and the court doesn't have jurisdiction over the person. When a plaintiff then makes an instruction for service, they themselves have taken an action which caused that second complaint to be dismissed. And there doesn't necessarily need to be a first complaint that's dismissed. And you could ultimately have the instruction for service after 1 year is a initial notice of dismissal, and then you have the right to refile. That's exactly what you did in Goolsbee. The problem here is you had the filing of the lawsuit, a dismissal, notice dismissal. You had a second filing. You went again beyond the one-year time period. Now you had a third filing, which was that instruction for service. And that triggers, how do you get rid of that second lawsuit? There's only three ways under Olnick, this court found. One is the party has the right for notice dismissal, and it's without prejudice the first time. It's with prejudice the second time. You have by stipulation of the parties, which didn't occur in this case, or you have by order of the court. They never moved the court to dismiss without prejudice. If they would have, the protections built in a revised code to look at whether it would be proper or not are there. If it was by stipulation, they would have had come to us and ask us.
So your distinction with the Goolsbee issue then is in Goolsbee, the service request for service acted as their first dismissal, and they were entitled to do a first dismissal. Here, you already had a first dismissal. The request for service out of time acted as a second dismissal. It was out of rule, and they're out of court. That's your basic analysis.
That's
is that
exactly
correct?
It. And I believe that's consistent with the holdings throughout the, you know, that this court has had, and also consistent with the Court of Appeals holding. And it's exactly the issue that the judge in the Schaefer case focused on. In the trial court decision, that's exactly what he do. He recognized that once you had a dismissal, and we attached it to our motion to dismiss before the trial court in this case, we attached a copy of it because the Court of Appeals didn't necessarily talk about that. They focused on dismissal. And
counsel, is this a frequently occurring scenario, or is this something that is very rare and kind of out of mainstream?
Well, it's actually surprising how much text there is about this issue in the Anderson Civil Rules, their text on it. I mean, there's a lot of discussion about it. There seems to be a lot of confusion over it. So we believe it is an important issue for litigants to understand. And there are multiple cases that are cited in the pleadings that focus on what does it mean when you instruct service, especially after the one-year time period has run? And it seems clear that it means that there is a refiling of the complaint. And the natural, so then it becomes, what ultimately happens with that original complaint? Is it a nullity? Did it never exist? The problem with focusing on its a nullity, then you could have unlimited 41 A1A dismissals, because if you never filed the complaint, never happened, the cause of action never really started, and therefore you could have unlimited notice dismissals, and I don't think that court would like this to occur. So I believe it is an important issue, and it's consistent with the Saunders decision, which talked about not only does 3A focus on really the duty to within a year get service, but that really is an obligation for the court and for litigants to pursue their action.
Counsel, the reply brief speaks to it, but distinguished Thomas versus Freeman, from that, the appellee, of course, claims it's right on and that disposes of this case against your client. What's your response?
Well, I think that there, what they failed to realize is that what was the import of that instruction for service the third time? and the fact that you had that series of dismissals. And I think that's really where how you distinguish the Thomas case.
Thank you, Mr. Slater.
Counsel, I have a further question here. It's not on the issue that's raised in the brief, but it is a jurisdictional question, and that is whether we really have a final appealable order here, because ordinarily a dismissal that is not on the merits is not a final appealable order. And of course, you're arguing that it is on the merits, but wouldn't that normally be determined if there were a refiling of the lawsuit? And it wasn't raised, obviously, by the parties, wasn't raised by the Court of Appeals, but yet it seems to be a question that needs to be answered, whether this court has jurisdiction over this question.
Well, we believe that there is, that there was a final appealable order, and in fact, if you follow the logic of our case, that instruction for service ultimately was the refiling, just as in Goolsbee. And when you have a refiling, at that point, it would be proper to move for dismissal, and that's exactly what we did. We moved for dismissal because they didn't have jurisdiction, and they had gone through their two dismissals earlier, so it was with prejudice as to these defendants. So we believe that it was a final appealable order at that point.
Except the court order was dismissed it without prejudice, which would not be on the merits, and that could be determined if there were a refiling, whether or not it was barred. So I just raised the question.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I think the concern here, though, is this matter has been pending since 2004, and I think ultimately it is an important issue that litigants should understand what their obligations are.
And I appreciate that, and you understand that a jurisdictional issue is a predicate question as to whether or not we can even decide the case.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slater. Mr. Owens.
I'm Timothy J. Owens, and I'm here on behalf of the appellees, Siskin Associates, Inc. And as this panel recognized, this is not a Rule 3A case. It's a Rule 41 case. The facts are relatively not in dispute, but clearly the tenor of appellant's presentation is that appellees just sat on their hands for 18 months regarding service in this case. That is not true. In December of 2005, after the case was refiled after a notice dismissal, there is an affidavit filed by counsel for appellants indicating that service was made. Subsequently, there were a number of motions filed in January and February of 2006, which were fully briefed to the court by March of 2006. Additionally, during that time, an amended complaint was filed as a matter of right under Rule 15, and at the time, because it was believed service had been made, that amended complaint was served upon the parties via Rule 5 on their counsel. Those motions stayed pending through February of 2007, when the new trial court judge had a status conference. We reviewed the procedure with the trial court judge. The resolution was that ordinary mail service would be made.
At that point, you realized the service hadn't been made.
Exactly.
So when you said...
Well, there had been no decision on any of the motions as to whether or not service had been made.
But you
agreed... The resolution
agreed-
was... We'll go forward and do it by regular mail, since we'd already tried certified mail, which had been refused, and that was agreed to. But what's key there, Your Honor, is that we're not arguing that service was accomplished there. What's key is the amended complaint that they're saying that the notice required effectively a dismissal of the original complaint and refiling isn't true. The amended complaint was already filed as a matter of right. It was simply the trial court saying, okay, we need to get service of this. This is how you will do it.
Well, wait a minute. Either you have service or you don't. And my understanding here, if the trial court ordered you to do service at that point, that's because you didn't have it and it was necessary to do. So for you to say that the amended complaint was filed already and good service had been made, so it was a refiling, or it was a filing of a complaint as of right.
If you didn't
have service, it wasn't.
It didn't require a dismissal of a complaint that was already pending and filing a new complaint, which is the essence of whether or not there was a double notice dismissal, and clearly there was not. We did not require a complaint to go away and then file yet another complaint.
Why not?
We simply asked for service a complaint that was already filed with the court, like in Goolsbee, where the court had sat, where no notice of instruction for service had been given to the clerk. We were simply following the trial court's direction.
What complaint was going to be filed based on that conference that you had with the court?
The amended complaint.
The amended complaint.
Yeah, that's what was served.
What happened to the complaint that never got filed, or never got served?
The amended complaint superseded that because it was filed as a matter of right under Rule 15 prior to responsive pleading, which we're allowed to do under the civil rules.
But wait a minute, that's presuming that you've got service to begin with, and before that party answers, you quickly file an amended complaint. But you're missing the first step, and that's valid service to allow for that amendment as of right.
Your Honor, at the time all this happened, there was an affidavit filed by counsel for the appellants indicating that service of the original complaint had been made. That is the fact.
Had been made?
Had been made.
But that was contested, wasn't it? And that was the subject of the motions that were pending. And while they were pending, nobody on your side did anything to fix it. You just kept waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting for the judge to rule.
Correct.
Instead, why don't you just go out and reserve it so that instead of waiting for a judgment on the ruling of whether you had service or not, just go out and reserve it?
We could have done that, Your Honor. I recognize that. But as this court noted in Goolsbee, had the trial court under Rule 4, after 6 months looked at it, at that point we would have a dismissal without prejudice and the ability to refile. And one of the distinctions in this case is the savings statute isn't at issue here. This is a contract case, a written contract case. The statute of limitations has not run. So under Olnick, as long as there are not two notice dismissals, we're not worried about the statute of limitations and whether or not we can refile the complaint. The statute still exists. We have finally, after the trial court's decision in September of 2007, after yet again certified mail being refused, finally obtained service via regular mail at about the date the appeal in this case was filed.
And you could have done that right when they filed their first motion to dismiss for lack of service. You could have done ordinary mail.
Could have done that, but we had a legal argument that we thought we were right. Ultimately, the trial court, you know, in their entering their decision in September of 2007, said we were wrong. But we could have changed or done additional service, but we thought we were right on the service issue.
And if you're wrong on the original complaint, you're serving the amended complaint on counsel is no good. No valid. It's not valid.
I understand. But again, the dismissal at that point would have been without prejudice. It wasn't a notice dismissal, and we're entitled to refile the lawsuit because we had obtained service on one of the defendants. And I think what is key here is that, as this court did in Goolsbee and following the policy in Thomas versus Freeman, is to look to see, have lawsuits decide on their merits, not on pleading procedures. And that is clearly what's at issue here. The merits can be addressed, they will be addressed, and the policy underlying Goolsbee and Freeman, this court has rendered decisions in, clearly state that unless there is a voluntary notice dismissal under 41A1A, the double jeopardy rule, for lack of a better phrase, under Rule 41 does not apply. And I would urge this court not to apply the double jeopardy rule to expand that, just as they declined to do in Olnick and in Goolsbee as well.
What is your response to Justice Cupp's question earlier as to whether or not this court even has jurisdiction? I'm over here.
Okay. Yes, Your Honor.
Whether we have jurisdiction, because this dismissal that we're here on is without prejudice.
Correct.
I believe the best argument is it should have been with prejudice because it was the second time and it can't be redone. Why shouldn't we wait until the third complaint gets filed and then deal with it then and say there have been two previous?
You can certainly do that, Your Honor.
I guess we can do whatever we want, actually.
Absolutely.
But the argument or the position is, and I think it's worth considering, I'd like your response, this isn't even a final appealable order at this point.
That issue was raised with the trial court. Appellant's position that since their position is it should have been dismissed with prejudice, that that raises the final appealable order issue. And that is
what's your position?
My position at the trial court is that it was not a final appealable order. And at this point, certainly the court could take that and say they do not have jurisdiction with it. It was not briefed at the Court of Appeals level, as counsel for appellant indicated, this case has been pending for a long time, and we're seeking some finality to it. Because we have one plaintiff, one defendant who has been served, the case has been stayed pending the resolution of this issue.
As Justice Kupp pointed out, of course, the final appealable order is a jurisdictional issue, and while we're interested in the efficient administration of justice, we can't do it if we don't have jurisdiction, do we?
I understand that.
Can we?
Just as if we take appellant's argument regarding the jurisdiction of the trial court when they allowed an extension of time for service, if you take the position that under Rule 3, they didn't have jurisdiction to do that either, at which point the case would have had to been dismissed prior to that attempt for service under Rule 4E.
Counsel, because you're dealing with a written contract and you have a long statute of limitations, is it your view that this process could be repeated over and over until the statute runs?
No, Your Honor, that's not my position. Under the unique procedural posture of this case, I strongly believe under Skolnick and under Thompson that there are no two notice dismissals in this case. That if I had a statutes problem, the fact that there are not two notice dismissals, that wouldn't save the day. I'd be barred by the statute of limitations. All I'm saying is without the two notice dismissals and the fact that we do not have a statute of limitations argument, in this unique procedural posture, we could go forward with the case.
But you, how often could you dismiss for failure to serve? In other words, could you file it, not get service, dismiss?
No, I have.
If not get service, dismiss.
There are no more notice dismissals available. If the court orders it dismissed under grounds where it is without prejudice, and that is a discretionary call by the trial court, and as the Court of Appeals recognized in this case, it was a discretionary call by the trial court. They made it, and there was no abuse of discretion that they could find in the record. Obviously, if the trial court dismisses with prejudice or determines that, you know, the only way for it to be dismissed is via a notice dismissal, then I have the crux of the problem right there. But the posture of the case right now, we haven't reached that point. Anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Owens.
Thank you.
Mr. Slater, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Justice Kupp, I thought there was a reason that the 54B wasn't dealt with, and it is because the trial court did enter an order on November 28, 2007 in the record indicating that it was a final appealable order and there was no just reason for delay. So there was that determination by the trial court and that language in the entry.
But that isn't necessarily binding on us if we find it not to be a final appealable order just because the trial court says it is. So.
Correct. I appreciate the precedent that exists there. But,
okay, but the trial court did
correct,
determine that.
Correct.
And issued a 54B order.
The secondly, and I think most importantly, is, again, there is 3A. The civil rules needs to mean something, and it means that there's a responsibility of the plaintiff to make sure that service is obtained. There's a discussion about in Goolsbee, the quote that, well, the clerk in the trial court had an obligation within 6 months to review, especially when original complaint was filed and there was an instruction not to make service, to do something within 6 months. In this case, though, and under the civil rules, Rule 4.6E, it is clear that the responsibility of confirming service is not on the trial court. It's not on the defendants. It is upon the plaintiff and plaintiff's counsel. And clearly, in this case, they wholly failed in following the correct procedure and taking any real action to pursue service within a year. And then when they finally decided to attempt to follow a procedure with through ordinary mail, and by the way, the reality is since they didn't try service by certified mail in that second case, they didn't have the right to even attempt ordinary mail.
Was that agreed to, though, at the court conference that they could, that ordinary mail was the agreed upon way of attempting this notification?
Well, they indicated, and they attached a copy of the pretrial order that indicated that, and specifically it says that our counsel didn't object to that. There's nothing in the record necessarily saying that we didn't object to it, but there was an order. The problem with—
There was a court order saying the plaintiff needs to serve the defendant via ordinary mail.
Correct, and if the court didn't have jurisdiction to do that, because if they did, that would be extending the 3A time period. And that's why that order had no effect, and the court really didn't have authority and jurisdiction under Saunders and the other precedent, because—
And that's one of the things that I find most troubling about this, is that why would there be a need for the court to order mail service on the defendants if, as Appellee says, that was already done? I'm not—
I wish I could explain that, Your Honor, but I can't. I know that under the civil rules, though, and under the precedent of this court, there was an authority to do that.
So if it wasn't already done, and this was just kind of a double service attempt, then there was absolutely no authority for the trial court to bypass the rules and go straight to a mail service.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Slater. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Take a brief recess.
All rise.